Hello, my name is Sam Clements and welcome to The Love of Cinema, a Picture House podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by director Craig Roberts, whose new film, The Phantom of the Open, is in cinemas from today.
I didn't choose golf.
It more it chose me. It was destiny.
Sorry! Flippin' heck.
Hello, Craig. How's it going?
Good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
It's honestly a pleasure, and you know, we've been such big fans of your work, both in front of the camera and behind the camera at Picture House. I think way back when we screened Just Jim in our Discover program, which was all about finding new filmmakers, and I think we played it across the group. Was that 2015, maybe, your directorial debut?
Good memory. Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, around then. Yeah, it seems like a lifetime ago, to be honest.
In the time of recording, you know, after the majority of the pandemic, time is just a mess anyway. So, did I see you recently? Oh, no, it was 2 years ago before the pandemic. That was when I last saw you. am I right in thinking you made Phantom of the Open during the pandemic? I saw some COVID credits, in really lovely end credits, by the way, so very retro looking.
Thanks very much. Yeah, we did actually. Yeah, it was the September of it all, and I think it was quite new to be filming. Or there were a few productions that had happened before that, so we really didn't know what we were going into. But in all honesty, it was absolutely fine to film in COVID. I felt very, you know, grateful that we were actually working, to be honest. And the only thing that happened really was that there weren't that many people behind the monitor, you know, less than they usually are. And that's a good thing. So, yeah, it was actually fine.
I guess there's lots of being, you know, the nature of this film, a lot of it does take place on a golf course. So you're outside. That was recommended advice as well, you know.
We were outside, that's right. We were outside and we had to have, it needed to look like a very hot summer and it loved to rain.
Oh, no.
So that was a challenge for sure.
Before you were, you know, not having crowds around a monitor and trying to make it look sunny in the UK, do you remember when this script came to you? What was your first, how did you first hear about this film?
About a year before we filmed, the producers, Nick Martin and Tom Miller, and the writer, Simon Farnaby, they came to LFF and saw my second film, Eternal Beauty. And then, I got sent the script and we just started talking about it, really. I think what they connected with Eternal Beauty was that there was this outsider, the protagonist, and I certainly wanted to design the picture in a way that we were with them, not laughing at them, laughing with. And I think that probably crossed over to Phantom a little bit with Morris and how peculiar he can be in you know, in certain scenarios. So I think that helped my fight for wanting to direct it, I suppose.
That must be quite, I know, like, you know, making anything is hard. Making films is so hard because there's so many moving parts. But when producers and scriptwriters are actually coming to you with a project, that must be quite a nice feeling.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, you feel very fortunate. I mean, I to be honest, I never thought I would direct someone else's script. I always, when I switched it up from acting, I wanted to, you know, I was writing to direct and wanted to write my own stuff, and had, you know, the pretentious idea that I'd be this auteur that would make all this stuff. But when Simon's script came through, I was kind of jealous that I hadn't written it, to be honest. And I just really loved the world and the characters. So I was like, yeah, I suppose this is probably gonna be the most commercial film I'll ever make. So why not give it a go?
Yeah, I guess it must be a different mindset, you know, and maybe I don't know. Does it feel like it's less pressure if you're coming in as a collaborator rather than it's all your idea, it's your story, then you're directing it, then you're responsible for delivering it?
there's more pressure, I think, with directing someone else's work, just because you want to, you know, you want to do right by it and you want it to be as good as they think it should be. Whereas, you know, it's only you to blame if you've written and directed it. It's all on you. So yeah, I think there was more pressure with that. And it, to be honest, it was just a fear of how I tell it and how I get into it and what was the way in, what, you know, what, how I could see it really. And it was strange that the bit that connected with me in the script, that kind of it all clicked together of how I would tell it, was Simon had a scene where Morris was coming out of the shipyard and he opened his work overalls and it was the way he'd written it was like Superman. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. And one of my favorite movies is Punch Drunk Love by Paul Thomas Anderson. And Barry Egan, for people that do or don't know, is Superman in that movie. You know, he's Clark Kent or an alien that's been beamed down and he has social anxiety because he doesn't have to deal with his powers. And I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll do my version of that. And so throughout the movie, there's loads of Superman references, loads of Easter eggs throughout it for nobody that's going to ever see it, really.
When I rewatched the film last night at home, the BAFTAs were also on telly, and they did the in memoriam section, and Richard Donner was in memoriam because he sadly passed away, and they played a clip from Superman, and then I went in straight into Phantom, and I was like, I just sort of blurred the two in my mind because Morris is a superhero, and that scene you talk about is so good with his like golf sweater underneath his work overalls.
I suppose there's many ways to tell this story, and there's a very British way of telling the story, which would be, you know, overly steeped in like, you know, social realism, and it'd be, you know, not the Ken Loach and Mike Lee are bad, they're brilliant, but you know, a very real version of it. But I suppose I loved Morris's optimism and his, I suppose his drive to like transcend his birth lottery in some kind of way. Superman was a good way of going into it, like, and small things like it just became the color palette, the colors of Superman, and we made his golfing outfit, whatever you call it, and we created it with like the diamonds with all the Superman color and stuff like that. So like just small things that nobody really will ever know about, but for me it just makes me sleep better at night.
I think it's good to have those little things in for you.
Yeah, exactly.
How, obviously this is based on a kind of a too good to be true sort of true story. how involved were the family, and again talking about the pressure of pulling something like this off when it's based on real people and real events, does that also add additional pressure to you in the director's seat?
Well, James Flitcroft, Morris's son that's still alive, he's been involved from the beginning, really. The producers have done a great job of keeping him involved, and that's been a good collaboration. And I know Mark did a lot of prep for the role. You know, there's a few videos out there that, you know, you can study, but he also went to Barrow and spent some time with James. So yeah, spent some time in the community. So he did a lot of work. I had the book that Simon had written, and I also looked at the videos. One thing I was conscious of, I didn't really want to make a down the line kind of biopic. You know, I didn't want that to be the case. I wanted it to be just kind of capturing Morris's spirit and his optimism, rather than it be an impression, because I think that's always dangerous. So yes, we did the research, but at the same time, I wanted it to, I suppose, be slightly different.
You never even played bloody golf before, Dad.
Mind your language on the course. F***ing hell.
So I guess it adds to the cinematic feel as well. Like, this is both times I've seen it now, I've been in tears at the end. I've been chuckling through it, and it is it's taking that essence and creating this sort of, you know, wonderful, feel good, you know, kind of like magical realism to a point, sort of film. I don't know if you see the film the same way as me, so I'm always very, you know, careful about describing someone's film to them, but that's how I interpreted it anyway.
Oh, that's good. No, yeah, I mean, and that was in Simon's script, you know, the kind of escapism of his fantasies and stuff, and that reminded me of Billy Liar. I love Billy Liar so much, and so much so that we actually got a clip of Billy Liar to put into the movie. So just before he discovers golf, Billy Liar's there in a fantasy of his own. So yeah, that definitely appealed to me. And again, it was just, you know, the scope of it and how we framed it was all based on how he saw the world, really. We wanted it to be colorful. And also, if you do it, you know, down the line, kind of, I suppose, a straight biopic, there's also an expectation, and I may be wrong with this, that it has to be bright and colorful all the time. Whereas, you know, we didn't really shoot it that way. We shot on film, and it's grainy in a lot of places and dark in a lot of places in terms of its aesthetic. And that just felt, I suppose, would help ground it. My fear was that it was a funny script, a really funny script. But we had to shoot it like a drama, so that in the back half of the movie, you could then cry and stuff like that. Whereas if we shot it like a comedy, a straight comedy, you know, where it's a wide, a medium, and a close, and it's overlit and you can absolutely see every detail of the face, it may not work so much towards the back end. Whereas this is not shot like a comedy at all. You know, a lot of the shots are on the zoom and are developing wides that turn into mediums and then a close and then whips off. There's a lot of whips. I saw somebody on Twitter say, Craig Roberts will pan anything and any whip, which is, I think, an insult, but that's fine.
I'll wear that with a badge of honor. I think that shooting on film is such a good idea, because it is a, you know, it's a period film set in the 70s and then goes into the 80s, and it just adds that like historical weight to it. It's also, as a modern audience member, it's so nice to see, because there is, you know, like you say, there are a lot of films out there which are oversaturated and very crisp, which is totally fine. But yeah, it sort of feels like a modern film. It doesn't feel like a period film if you're watching something like that. So it's a really nice shortcut for the audience.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, that was the plan. And but also, I love film. I love shooting on film. I love the discipline of it all. I overprepare. And it's not really about finding it on the day or improvising much. It's about, you know, having a plan going into it. And if that's the case, then film kind of lends itself to that. Whereas I think if I was discovering it, you know, every day and didn't have a shot list, it would be very, very expensive.
Yeah. It's a lot of reels to get processed.
Yeah.
You mentioned Mark Rylance earlier, you know, amazing as Morris as the lead. And you've also got, you know, him wonderfully paired with Sally Hawkins, who's so good in this film, and someone you've worked with on a number of times. I was just wondering, what keeps bringing you and Sally back together?
Well, I love Sally. I think she's the best. We're really good friends. And I think it's much easier if you can get to work with friends. There's the shorthand there. And, you know, when you come together on a set, you normally get 5 or 6 weeks to shoot an independent film. And, you know, the first couple of those weeks are trying to figure people out and how they work. And it's, you know, that just makes it a lot easier if you know them. And she's also she's the best. Like, she is the best. I think she's incredible. There's nothing she can't do. When I read this script, I was like, we have to have Sally in that role, because she's just going to ground absolutely everything. And she's the heart of the movie, really. Morris wouldn't be able to achieve his dreams or go for them without her and her support, really. So that was incredibly important. And also just Sally Hawkins and Mark Rylance. I don't know how they've not been in a movie together before.
No, that's true. I mean, it does have that, like, people throw around the word national treasure, but you've got two of them in this film playing a couple. And they're such a good, the characters are so good together. It's not like they resent each other or anything. They're a loving couple, really supportive. And they are it's a two-person operation there, really.
It really is. Also, when you get, you know, I think part of directing is just like conducting and just making sure you have people that can, you know, play the instruments very, very well. And with those two, they're the best at it. So it does make your life a lot easier. You just, at that point, you just need to make sure the camera's in the right place, which is the hardest thing to do, but you're hoping you're doing it justice.
When I saw it at the cinema, LFF, like, it was getting such a good response from the audience, and, you know, that's true to everything. But Sally Hawkins and Mark Rylance, they really cut through and resonate. I think they bring so much life to those characters, and they deliver on the humor and they deliver on the emotional scenes.
And that's a tough thing to do, you know, the tone. It's really, really tough to get it right, and that's all down to them, really. You know, they're the ones, you know, executing the lines in the right way. So it's all on them how the tone works out, which I'm very grateful for.
And okay, just finally for the Pitch House interview, the film's in cinemas right now. When one of your films opens, across the country, what do you do on day of release? Do you sneak into your local and sort of watch the film at the back?
Well, to be totally honest with you, this is a new experience for me. I've made very indie movies before this, and, you know, the release has been limited. So, yeah, I suppose I don't go to the cinema to watch them. And there's no, like, pressure or expectation that they're going to do incredibly well. Whereas this is slightly different. You know, E1 are doing a fantastic job of releasing it. And it feels like a good time to release a movie like this that's hopeful and escapism, really. So I don't know. I'm going to be panicking, definitely, come Friday. But I think I'm going to go to Wales and watch it in the Showcase Cinema in a place called Nangaru, because that's where I grew up in. That's where my parents taught me to watch movies and stuff. So I think we're all going to go as a family and watch it there.
That'd be great seeing your poster. And I always wondered, it's like, if I was a filmmaker and I was on the tube or in my local cinema and I saw a poster for my film or the bus adverts, which I know E1 are doing for Phantom. Like, if I saw my movie on the side of a bus, that's huge.
It's pretty strange. Yeah. And I see the pictures and I don't really kind of feel anything about it. And I think that's mainly because I'm trying not to think about it too much.
Yeah.
I think the more I think about it, the more panicked I'd become. So, I'm just very, very, very grateful to E1 for the release they're doing. They're really behind it, and I love that.
That's brilliant. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Craig. We're looking forward to playing the film at Picture House, but, you know, it is playing wide across the country. So, listeners, please go and check out Phantom of the Open. Do keep an eye. It might be on your local bus sites as well, but see it with a nice big audience, I think. You want to go on a busy, you know, like, weekend showing. And enjoy.
Thanks so much, Sam. Thanks for saying that.